Это его выбор.
Сам решил покинуть свой пост.
Владимир Якунин сообщил о своем решении в Телеграме.
Владимир Якунин попрощался с коллегами из РЖД.
Поэтому для Якунина это очень неплохой выход.
Что стоит за этой кадровой ситуации? Перестановкой? Безусловно, крупнейшей за последние несколько лет.
He was supposed to be untouchable. He was supposed to be immortal. He was supposed to be eternal. Few members of the Russian elite looked as unassailable as Vladimir Yakunin. He's been personally close to Vladimir Putin for decades, going back to the Ozero Dacha Cooperative of the 1990s. He ran the massive state company Russian Railways and had close ties to the Russian Orthodox Church. He was a key member of the Kremlin's inner sanctum. He was consistently ranked among the most powerful men in the country. So when somebody like Yakunin takes a fall, it's a sure sign that all is not well inside the collective Putin. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia Security Services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark. It's just you and me today.
Yeah, it's almost lonely. Hi there.
It feels like old times. Well, as we all know, Yakunin announced last week that he was stepping down as the head of Russian Railways to take the largely ceremonial and largely meaningless post of representing Kaliningrad in the Federation Council. A clear demotion, or at least it looks like that on the surface. Mark, on your blog, you laid out four scenarios about what Yakunin's departure may mean. He may have fell from grace. How you put it, it was time for the technocrats. He wants to spend more time with his money, great subhead, or he's being prepped for promotion. Which do you think is truer or most plausible there?
Well, I mean, it's still difficult to know. I mean, we're very much speculating, but I think we're beginning to get a few little data points that are suggesting that this isn't just a random one-off that Yakunin fell from grace because, I don't know, he didn't let Putin win at Conkers or something like that, or that even that necessarily he's being planned as, you know, one zealous Orthodox Christian ex-spook from St. Petersburg's choice as a potential prime minister, because he might like a zealous Orthodox ex-spook from St. Petersburg. No, I think there's three points that I think suggest that this is part of something bigger. First of all, we've had another, not anything like as high profile, but another significant stepping down, Yevgeny Dodd from Ruskidro. Yeah. And again, it's one of these kind of state oligarchs, mm-hmm. Rather than purely sort of business figures. And in fact, we've also got Vyedomosti talking about potentially a wider purge within RZD. The Russian railways, which, after all, you know, is not only a sort of huge and strategic industry within Russia, but in 2014 it lost, I think, 100 billion rubles that had to be then picked up by the state. But then, most interestingly, is actually reading in recent days, coverage in the Russian press and the tenor of the briefing, because what's been coming out has been very much from unnamed high-level Kremlin presidential administration and so forth sources, that actually Yakunin's departure followed a meeting with Putin at which Putin was basically saying, you're going to have to make RZD operate more efficiently. Yakunin said that there's no way he could cut costs and therefore, by implication, subsidies from the federal budget. And so Putin basically said, well, fair enough, then off you go. Now, that's interesting, firstly, because clearly it's being pitched to show Putin as the tough manager who is willing to cleanse the stables. But it also actually makes Yakunin look like the profligate figure who, while having his massive mansion with its own climate-controlled fur vault and everything else, nonetheless is expecting the rest of Russia to pick up pieces for his misadministration, which is not how you pitch someone who you might be planning to make your next prime minister.
Mm-hmm. So, Whether or not that is actually how it went down.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, it makes it less likely that this is part of some positive game for Yakunin, and more that actually this is part of definitely a sort of a disposal of him. Now, yeah.
No, and I was along those lines to support your point. I was listening to Alexei Venediktov's program Osoba Mnenia the other day, where he said this is a clear demotion. Venediktov's plugged in, and he said there's no doubt this was a demotion, no doubt whatsoever. So that supports.
Yeah, because I mean, let's be honest. Being a senator isn't powerful, but it is honorific. And Kaliningrad is a funny choice, an interesting choice rather, because precisely it is strategically important. It's not just some nowhere province in the middle of Russia. And my apologies to all the nowhere provinces in the middle of Russia. You know, it is very much at the front line of not just the new geopolitical struggle with the West, but also the cultural, religious, moral, etc. struggle, which is, after all, one of the things that Yakunin stands for. So in and of itself, that senatorial position could be a sort of a... It could be a comfortable sinecure. It could be it's time for you to go, but you're obscenely wealthy and we'll give you a platform from which you can still continue to have your views heard.
Carry the Kremlin's water ideologically, I might add.
Exactly. But this is part of the rules of the game. Yakunin may well have, for whatever reasons, had to go. But on the other hand, he had been a loyal member of the system, and therefore he will go in a way that is essentially honorable and not in any way damaging his obscene wealth. He had not become a threat or an opposition. He'd just become an inconvenience. So, I mean, I suspect that that's the way we're heading. Now, the question is just, you know, just last one I make here is whether or not this is still essentially just simply about, well, let's just get rid of a few people and see what goes on, or whether there is a bigger game plan behind it.
Well, and Kaliningrad is interesting for another reason, too. You alluded to it slightly, but it's also that one of Yakunin's roles, one of the roles he's played for this regime is recruiting, let's face it, figures of the far right, movements of the far right in Europe through his Dialogue of Civilizations. He's been kind of the point man on this. Now, he's not going to physically be in Kaliningrad, but he's going to be representing Kaliningrad. But this may be a good entree to continue with that role. But let's go through, because I've kind of threw out my basic four theories about what this could be. The first being what you just laid out, the purge theory, the cleansing of the elite. Now, this would suggest, would it not, that Yakunin's not the last to go. And I don't mean Yevgeny Dod. I mean fish as big as Yakunin. And what does that mean? Putin is very loyal to his friends. Now, as Leonid Bershitsky memorably wrote in his blog, as loyal as he may be realizing that Russia's companies need to be run by better managers than his buddies, to use Leonid's memorable phrase there. Do you think people like Sechin, Alexei Miller are in danger? Gazprom is not exactly well run, nor is Rosneft. RJD is hardly the only state company that keeps begging for subsidies. I mean, when you're an oil company that has to beg for subsidies, you got a problem, right?
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, actually, my view, and perhaps this is sort of the hopeless product of someone who remembers fondly when British Rail was a state monopoly in the UK. Actually, you know, railway systems should not, in many ways, be profit centres, especially for a huge, sprawling country like Russia. They are, as much as anything else, just part of the national strategic infrastructure. As you say, for gas and oil companies to be begging for money.
As Gazprom and Rosneft are.
Indeed. And it's quite interesting that, even Sechin, who, even more than Yakunin, we have tended to regard as a fixture, you know, Sechin lives and Sechin will live. But even he has had some public slapdowns of late. Now, I don't know how far this is just wishful thinking on my part to think that Sechin may be at all vulnerable. But I think what is clear is that the Russian state is settling in for the long term. It knows that actually what it thought was going to be perhaps a short-lived spasm of irritation from the West and a short-lived blip in oil prices is not going to happen. Sanctions are going to continue. This relationship, this rather fraught relationship with the West, will continue, and oil is not going to suddenly pop back up to convenient levels. Mm-hmm. So I think they are already beginning to sort of create a new architecture for survival in a rather tougher era. I mean, you've written about this in your blog about sort of preparing for a new era of austerity. And I think one of them is precisely getting in the kind of managers who are not necessarily more efficient. I mean, if we look at Alek Belozerov, the new person in charge of the railways, he doesn't have a track record as either an incompetent, but nor as a star.
But he was lobbied for by the Rottenberg brothers, Arkady and Boris, as Viedemisty reported, if you believe what Viedemisty reported.
We have one report to that effect. I don't know. And if so, that
Viedemisty's got good sources.
Viedemisty has good sources, but also precisely for that reason, that if you want to plant information, that's where you plant it.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, we don't know, but certainly, I mean, he is not a mold breaker. Mm-hmm. But what he is certainly not is a figure of the kind of power and heft of a Yakunin. So in other words, what this has done is it makes Erzhedeh more easy for the state to control. Yakunin could push back up to a point, as we discovered, in a way that Belozerov won't be able to. So I think this is part of a, if not a taming of the elite, but a taming of some of the big economic beasts within the Russian system, just to more or less say, look, you're going to have to stand on your own two feet. You're going to have to bring in economies or efficiencies or something, because you can't just assume that the Kremlin and the federal budget is going to be bailing you out all the time.
Do we expect the Sechins and the Millers to be nervous? I'm not sure about that. I mean, if one of those, when my second data point I'm waiting for is somebody of that heft to go down. If Sechin goes down or Alexei Miller goes down, then we got something. Then I think we're looking at something serious. Until then, I think the jury's out. No,
it is. I mean, we have to realize, I mean, one of the interesting differences is that whereas Sechin or Miller, you might say, could be considered bigger fish, certainly economically, maybe politically, Yakunin was actually closer than either of them to Putin personally.
Yes.
So this is a big deal. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, and again, how far this is just wishful thinking on my part. The day that Sechin decides that, in fact, he really wants to, I don't know, take up sort of fishing or go and join a charity or whatever, that will be something pretty massive. But are these people worried? Well, I imagine they are. I mean, how do we know? But for two reasons. First of all, is exactly, they have built their careers not on efficient management, but on their ability to manipulate the state. I mean, if you look at Sechin's strategy, it's never been to be more efficient than his rivals. It's been to basically blast his rivals with the power of governance. He had not much more than a draw on the whole Bashneft issue when he took on Yevtushenkov. Yevtushenkov was for a while imprisoned, but then was brought back from the wilderness, and Bashneft shares did not instantly and freely transfer into Gazprom's Rosneft's hands, as he'd hoped. But already Sechin hadn't been demonstrating quite as much political clout as he has in the past. And secondly, I think the point is that once a Yakunin goes, and it's interesting just how much discussion there has been about the Yakunin ouster in the Russian media, it's clear that, you know, there is no standard party line yet.
No.
Except what we're now getting from Viedomosti. It doesn't seem like people know exactly what's going on. And in this kind of situation, uncertainty is really important. Uncertainty says something about how the rules of the game are shifting.
Or that the uncertainty is by design to keep people on their toes, maybe.
That's a little bit too clever. Mm. Yeah, I know we're going to come later on to the whole "is there a grand plan" notion, but I think every time we've looked for a big, long-lasting grand plan, and especially one that isn't leaked very quickly, we tend to be disappointed. Mm.
Now, going on to the next, I mean, another one of the things I think this could be, and I think this plays into the purge theory, the cleansing of the elite, is this what I call the brave new Russia theory. I wrote a blog on this week that perhaps all this craziness we've been seeing through the month of August, the destruction of the food, the bulldozer running over the banned Polish goose meat in Tatarstan. All of this craziness is part of a, I called it reverse shock therapy, perhaps. that Putin, the regime, is preparing the country for a new age of austerity. Well, does the Yakunin thing fit into that, that the elite's also being prepared for a new age of austerity? And maybe I'm giving them too much credit right now, but...
No, I think actually this is entirely plausible. I mean, I was struck, I was there for 4 weeks recently, and in some ways Moscow felt less hysterical than it had at around Easter. I think people had grudgingly and reluctantly started to come to terms with the fact that the current crisis was not going to lead to an instant catastrophic collapse or anything like that. But on the other hand, nor was it going to be short term. And I think what we're actually seeing is exactly an extension of that. It's actually turning a recognition that this is sort of the new normal, and beginning to build some kind of a sort of strategy, and in some ways a new elite etiquette around that. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if you're talking about the food, for example, these ridiculous and frankly obscene pictures of sort of, you know, food being bulldozed and burnt and whatever. It's not because the Kremlin had gone insane. I think it's precisely it knew it needed some kind of shocking symbolic gesture to A, say, don't try smuggling because it's not going to work, but B, to actually break people out of a sense of complacency, to make people realize that something different was happening. And likewise, with the elite, I mean, I've used the term a cleansing. I think that's probably in some ways too optimistic. It's not necessarily, I think, the next generation of elite are going to be any more honest. I think it's more perhaps, firstly, that they have to be a bit more efficient. I mean, it's quite interesting how Lenta.ru, which is an outlet that does tend to be quite close to certain sort of wings of the government, described Belozerov as a technokrat kozaistvennik. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially, again, it's not just a technocrat, but a sort of technocrat, manager. Handyman, manager, productive person. Not a politician, not a national leader, someone who'll get the job done. And of course, he will no doubt do very well out of that. But I think, again, you know, something that we've talked about in the past, perhaps a recalibration of just how well you can do, how much you can steal. I think that is a crucial thing. This is not going to be a system which suddenly decides that the elite can no longer steal, because then there will be no elite left. But on the other hand, a time to say you can't steal quite as much as you could in the past, and that's why we need to sort of shift people around. So yeah, I do think that it's sort of moving into a more survival-oriented mode, which is going to have to be a more austere mode.
Now, this leads into the next thing, is like, and I think what you're saying is, and what we're saying is, I think what Putin is trying to do, but I'm not sure everybody in the elite is down with this. And this leads to the panic and chaos theory. One of the things that one of my takeaways from the departure of Yakunin, one of the questions I had was, is this the death of the fabled collective Putin? Remember, we've talked, you know, in the past, we've talked about the collective Putin, Putin's Politburo, the inner sanctum of the deep state is how you and I have called it in the past. These 12 or so people who are really Russia's rulers. Yakunin was one of them, and not just one of them, one of the most powerful among them. And he, now, has he been banished from the island? Is the collective Putin still operating anymore? And if that's the case, because Russia's been ruled as much by the collective Putin as by the individual Putin, what does that say about the future of this regime?
It's an interesting question. And again, I'm going to give you the very unsatisfying answer of, in some ways, it's too soon to tell. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing for me will be to see whether or not Yakunin, in his post-RJD incarnation, still seems to be in Putin's inner sanctum. Because mm-hmm. In a way, for example, one can look at the extent to which Kudrin, although clearly no longer anywhere near as central or as influential, but still is somewhere in, as it were, maybe band two of the collective Putin, still has some degree of impact. So office and relationship to the Tsar don't have to match.
No.
So what we might see is a shift to an even more informal collective Putin. Because anyway, I mean, let's face it, it was always ridiculous the extent to which Yakunin was influencing policy on issues that had nothing to do with railways anyway. It really showed the extent to which this was a court rather than a government. Right. Well, the interesting thing was, you know, whether or not it just still continues, whether it just is sort of, you know, my friend, the senator for Kaliningrad, will be telling us about Far Eastern policy or whatever other issue. But the second thing is, what we have seen, in some ways, I'm not so much interested or expecting to see any great change in the people who are currently in the circle, precisely because they're in the circle because Putin liked them rather than whatever job they had. The question will be whether or not the technocrats begin to be brought back into the collective Putin, because they have been progressively squeezed out. There's no way that one can look at the sections of this world and think of them as technocrats. But the Shoigus, the Sobyanins, the people who basically...
Well, Shoigu's in there. Shoigu's definitely in there.
I'm really not convinced. I certainly don't think he had any kind of significant role when it came to deciding policy over Crimea and Ukraine, the most militarily significant issues of late. I think Shoigu, I mean, he's well-regarded, but he's a well-regarded groundskeeper rather than someone you have to dinner. It's a question of whether these people begin to be brought back in. Because this is always one of the strengths of, as it were, the early collective Putin in his first two presidential terms. He had a mix of chums and people who knew what they were talking about, and ideally people who were both. What's happened over time is essentially the chums have come to dominate, the circle has shrunk, and the people who knew what they were talking about are just, you know, including people also like Lavrov, let's remember, have been very much kept out. Their job is just simply to execute policy. Will they come back in? If they do, first of all, it'll actually potentially make policymaking much more rational, which is one reason why I don't think it's going to happen. But secondly, it will really signal an astonishing intellectual shift on Putin's part, a realization that he screwed up in terms of how he has created his decision-making processes. And that's another reason why, alas, I don't think this is going to happen. I don't think we're going to see any significant shift in the collective.
Well, let me throw something provocative out there so you can shoot it down. Now, you noted the kind of the how people were not nearly as hysterical in Moscow when you were there in July, if I'm not mistaken, right? Was it
and early August.
In early August. I've been noticing that the chattering classes have been getting increasingly hysterical. I just read an interview Alexei Venediktov gave to Novy Kaliningrad. It's a regional website. A very long, in-depth interview where he said basically the struggle of the Kremlin towers is going on as it always has gone on, but it's changed. The nature of it has changed. Where in the past, it was a struggle for Putin's ear, for influence over Putin, for proximity to Putin. Now it's a struggle to distance yourself from Putin in a graceful manner so as not to be accused of betrayal. He says, basically, the rats are jumping off the sinking ship. I couldn't help. He did not explicitly note Yakunin in this. But I couldn't help, and I'm sure you couldn't help, but think of that when in that formulation. Do you see, because I don't, again, maybe I could see a lot of people not really crazy about this situation. It might not just be people like Yakunin who want to be able to continue to steal, but it might be people who said, look, if we would just change policy and get out of this mess in Ukraine, get our relations with the West back to normal, we wouldn't be in this mess. Right. And there's signals that people are putting signs out to the West. Recall Sergei Lavrov earlier this month, two times in the course of a week saying, well, Putin is ready at any time for a meeting with Obama, and from the White House, crickets. And a couple of days, we're not going to beg, but, you know, any time Putin is ready to meet with Obama. Again, there's signs of panic. A little bit. There's signs that, and there's a sense among the chattering classes that people expect something to happen. Another, and Venediktov, I would add, is somebody who's very plugged in. He is very plugged in. Valery Solovey, the professor at Moscow State Institute of International Relations, has a Facebook page, heavily trafficked Facebook page. He wrote just a week or so ago that he expects this regime to fall in the not too distant future, and that he expects it to be bloodless and banal. Now, this is, again, not somebody who's, you know, this isn't somebody who's hysterical. This is somebody who's a very sober observer of Russian affairs and an insider, a professor at MGMO, right? So you're starting to see this. And again, I can't help but wonder. I'm not saying this is where my expectations are right now, but wonder if, regardless of what Putin's trying to do, and I think we are on mark saying what he's trying to do, everybody might not be down with this, because for the simple reason that if we were not pursuing this policy line and everybody wasn't down with this policy line, we wouldn't be in this mess. So maybe there's Andrei Piankovsky, who will go to the extremes, said there's already a search underway for a successor, for example, and that successor will normalize relations with the West. Normalize would mean something akin to what we had in Putin's first two terms, not what we had during Gorbachev or Yeltsin, of course. How would you react? How would you respond to this?
I think it's interesting. I mean, I think we need to unpick some of these elements. I mean, first of all, let's just mention that the chattering classes
are hysterical. Though,
are hysterical. I mean, they're the ones who were convinced when Putin disappeared that there was a coup in place. And a lot of them are desperately looking for escape routes. I mean, this is the thing that strikes me, is that those who can get the hell out have. Those who haven't, a lot of them are looking for the job abroad, the fellowship, anything that will actually get them out, even if it's just a temporary thing. Again, I think this is interesting. It speaks to the sense that something is going to happen. And they're not quite sure what, but so it's good to have a bolt hole, at least to be able to observe it from a safe distance. Now, the second point I'd make also is, I mean, the Lavrov point. I think it's worth mentioning that it plays to Putin's narrative, or the Russian narrative, if they can then say, we're perfectly happy to talk, it's the Americans who aren't. But more generally, you see, I mean, I've long felt that exactly Putin's regime will fall in a bloodless and banal way, that it won't be tanks in Red Square, it won't be an open competition in front of an electorate. It will instead be
a palace coup,
and precisely one that really the majority of the elite will be part of, or the upper elite, the boyars.
This is what I'm driving at. Are these things, because he's basically taking everybody's cheese away, you know, now he's taking away Yakunin's right to steal, and possibly Sechin and others. Are we getting to that point?
Yeah, I don't actually believe that Putin has the capacity to reinvent himself. I don't believe he has the capacity to reinvent this regime. Yes, he will try to do so. But first of all, to do that, Putin will have to do more than just simply provide congenial sinecures for a handful of particularly bloated embezzlers. Needless to say, I'm not mentioning Yakunin in that context. But
he's been known to sue.
Exactly. But generally speaking, actually, it will mean taking a very tough line and genuinely purging. You know, a polite dismissal and allowing people to keep millions of dollars is not a purge.
Right.
So actually, it would require Putin to be willing to take on the upper elements of his own elite in a way that we've seen no evidence that he's willing or indeed able to do. Secondly, it means that you have to have a next generation that is willing to do that. You know, who knows? I have no idea what Belozerov is. He's not exactly a figure who has been on anyone's radar, right, particularly. But on the other hand, I mean, if one looks at his background, Deputy Minister of Transport, and before that he was in charge of the Federal Roads Agency, not agencies which have been distinguished as being very well managed and as clean and pure as the driven snow. You know, there's nothing to suggest that this is actually some kind of, cleanser in chief.
It's a half measure.
Exactly. It's a half measure. It's finding someone who just seems, you know, whose face fits and who perhaps is going to be less pushy and less inclined towards embezzlement. This does not represent a dramatic reshaping of a regime. So in that respect, yeah, I'm with Piankovsky. I think there are already quiet conversations, very, very discreet, kitchen table in the opulent dacha conversations about a post-Putin presidency. And whether it's that they're going to be looking for an individual or whether it's going to be, as with the fall of Khrushchev, that they want someone who basically will become a congenial chairman of the board to essentially be the figurehead for oligarchy. In which case, hey, newly anointed Deacon Medvedev may well actually sort of have a role. Whatever. I mean, who knows? At the moment, I mean, again, I think there is nothing at the moment more dangerous than to begin to be discussed as the potential next Putin. But nonetheless, I'm absolutely certain, and certainly, I mean, I've had hints, that those kind of conversations are underway. The problem is, who actually starts the process? I think this is the thing. It's actually... I think this is why we're going to see a long period in which nothing seems to happen, and then it'll happen unexpectedly and quickly, because someone will start and then it'll suddenly momentum will go that way, or there will be some suitable excuse, like, you know, I don't know, Putin is ill, or a tremendous economic problem, or something like that. But up to that point, things are going to be very much subterranean.
But could they continue to muddle through in these economic circumstances? You got oil, you know, down near $40 a barrel. You got the ruble inching up to 70 rubles to the dollar. There is an economic crunch. There are objective factors driving this, and you have to wonder. My instinct was always that they would muddle through until the 2018 presidential elections, and then if a move was going to be made, it was going to be then if the elite was together on this, they would say to Putin, "It's time to step aside." But is it possible?
Well, they can muddle through for a while. I mean, firstly, I still feel that next year's Duma elections are potentially, and I stress the potentially, one of the crunch points. Not because the regime is going to lose. Of course not. They're going to ensure that they win. But the point is that they will know how much they had to fiddle and massage the results in order to get the outcome they wanted. So in some ways, even if actually the Duma outcome is a foregone and rigged conclusion, this does represent a kind of plebiscite on the way things are going, particularly because at the moment we still see these high approval ratings for Putin, which of course are in part artificial, but actually also reflect...
Although the Levada poll shows it going down, from 89 to 83, but still... Down.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. But I think the main thing, for me, the interesting thing is not, as it were, the Putin's personal thing, because how far is Putin in some ways a totemistic figure? It's more that when you ask people things like, do you feel the country is going in the right
55%,
direction?
55%. 55. Exactly. That's down.
These are doing badly. So, I mean, there clearly is a mood of discontent within the country. And in some ways, I think precisely that's more likely to be reflected in Duma elections rather than presidential elections. And from the elite's point of view, you would rather not have to shift things near a presidential election. What you want is to be able to install someone and give them a year or two to build their personal myth before the elections. So, I mean, I'm wondering if late 2016, early 2017 is going to be more of a sort of potential point. But the thing is, what we have is yes, Russia can muddle on absolutely for quite some time. In some ways, it's a little bit like Tsarist Russia after the assassination of Stalypin, which for me represented the point at which the last sort of creative opportunity for Tsarist Russia was lost. But the point is, inertia maintains it until something comes along that shatters it, which in this case was World War One. Yeah. Now, I don't believe that there's going to be sort of some grand war, but nonetheless, what happens is that regimes tend to survive until something comes to give them a push. And that's the unpredictable factor. Some new Chernobyl-type incident at one of Russia's nuclear reactors, a sudden explosion of violence in the North Caucasus, something happening to Putin medically, whatever. Who knows what particular black swan happens to flap its wings. Right. But that's the point where we suddenly would see the fragilities, the brittleness of the system come to the fore.
And on the last thing before we move on to the second half, one of the theories I saw floated. This was one of the most interesting theories I saw floated about Yakunin, was that this is part of a plan to turn the Federation Council into something akin to the House of Lords, to move a lot of these Putin cronies, high level Putin cronies like Yakunin, into the Federation Council, and it would create a kind of bulwark for the regime. Yakunin might become speaker. But to change the nature of the Federation Council. This is the most interesting of the kind of master plan political plans I saw here. What do you make of that?
Interesting, but I'm not convinced. No, I mean, I think, first of all...
Well, it does make sense in terms of the things we were saying. If there is going to be a move of Putin's buddies out of... If this is a general cleansing, then they got to go somewhere. And why not the Federation Council? There's going to be those presidential seats that you can put in the Federation Council now.
The point is, first of all, in some ways, the Federation Council already is that.
But for a lower level, a lower order of
yeah, but
of
the point
figures.
Is, people are not... How can I put this?
It's going to create new peers.
But the point is, I mean, in Russia, frankly, being obscenely rich is being obscenely rich, and that brings with it power and everything else. Yes, it's nice to have a seat on the Federation Council, but it's not as though... I don't think there's any suggestion that actually becoming a senator is not going to suddenly bring you a $15 million salary.
No, it would be for people who already have this. It would be a place for Yakunins to sit.
And to be honest, I don't think that really makes a big deal. Yeah, it's handy to give someone an honorific, but as I said, I think that's already happened. I just don't think there's anything to do. Because if one looks at the House of Lords, I mean, the House of Lords is, in the UK, is a ridiculous anachronism. But really, its value was way back when it was a way of house training your particularly ruthless and long-sworded aristocrats and turn them into supporters of the state. You've already got the mechanisms to do that, and it's called the tax police. In a way, these people can already be tamed. So, I mean, I think, first of all, I'm skeptical about any kind of grand plans notion. But secondly, I really don't see that as being in and of itself the kind of thing that actually would provide a haven, because people have got havens. They can just simply be wealthy people. They will have their own charitable foundations. They can endow think tanks that can then, as they do already, which can put out their messages. If you are obscenely rich, you do not need a Federation Council seat.
Mm. No, I saw that. I thought it was interesting. Thought I'd throw it out there.
But I think it also says something about how Russians are trying to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. And again, try and find meaning in what might just simply be a single data point. But also, it says something that if there was a grand plan, I think we would start to have the leaks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the suggestion is not, in my opinion, coming out of leakage so much as just simply random speculation.
Yeah, as the initial Reuters report on this said, it in a move that wrong-footed Kremlin watchers everywhere, I said here, because this one had me scratching my head. Okay, well, in a few minutes, we'll continue our discussion and broaden the aperture a bit and look at the tumultuous 6 months since Boris Nemtsov was assassinated. I'd like to remind you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Ровно полгода назад, ночь 27-го...
В Москве, в Сахаровском центре, вспоминали...
Борис Немцов ушел полгода назад.
Он стал бессмертным,
Борис Немцов был авторитетом для подавляющего
большинства. Притягивающий магнит.
И очевидно только, что он был очень масштабным человеком. Очень не хватает.
Конечно, Борис незаменим.
Half a year has passed since that chilly and fateful February night when opposition leader Boris Nemtsov was gunned down on a bridge just blocks from the Kremlin. In those 6 months, we've learned some things. We've learned that Chechen strongman Ramzan Kadyrov, widely suspected as the man behind the hit, can get away with practically anything. And we've learned that the FSB is not happy about this and is determined to knock Kadyrov down a peg. Over the past half year, some other things have also become apparent. Most notably, Vladimir Putin's mastery over Russian politics does not seem as total as we had assumed since the Ukraine crisis began. He appears to have backed himself into a corner at home and in Ukraine, and his courtiers appear to be getting nervous. What is your take on the last 6 months, Mark? That's mine.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, Putin never had true mastery over the system. He was effective at holding together this regime. But I think definitely what we're seeing in these past 6 months has been chickens coming home to roost, even if these are chickens sometimes the size of ostriches. And I still feel that, in a way, the clinchers have been one long-term and one short-term decision. The long-term decision was that during the first two presidential terms, you know, a period of sustained, average 7% economic growth, none of that money was seriously put to useful purposes. Yeah, it was stashed away in some, you know, some of it was put away into long-term reserves. But let's be honest, that is in many ways the sock under the mattress. The real things that needed to be done in terms of infrastructure and above all economic diversification, completely neglected. And this is what's coming home to bite them now, because they're just so dependent on oil prices. So that's the long-term chicken. He said, wishing he hadn't actually raised that metaphor in the first place. The second one, the one that is actually sort of clucking more obviously at the moment, is, of course, Ukraine. And this fateful decision not to take Crimea. Frankly, if they'd stopped at Crimea, I think they would have got away with it. Yes, there would have been a certain cost, but they probably would have weathered that particular storm by now, and we probably would be in reset territory, God help us all. Instead, by deciding to roll forward in a fit of over-optimism and overconfidence and move into the Donbass, where they really have got stuck in this political as well as military quagmire, that, I think, has been a truly disastrous step. Far more important than what happened in the case of Nemtsov and Kadyrov and on a lot of these other issues. I think actually the fact that they are stuck in Ukraine in a conflict to which it's actually very difficult to see any positive outcomes for them. You know, the best they can really hope for is a least worst option. That, I think, is compounding what is ultimately still the crucial issue. And I think the last point I'd make is what we're really seeing is the regime's limited and, frankly, pretty much non-existent capacity to adapt. Now, this happens to most regimes. I mean, most governments are not very good at adapting. Authoritarian regimes tend to be especially bad at adapting. Authoritarian regimes that have been around for more than a decade, especially bad at adapting. So in some ways, we shouldn't be surprised. But I think this is why it's a very brittle combination when you put together a regime that can't change with a certain set of circumstances that demand and require change.
And to take your two chickens, if they had tended to that first chicken, they could have maybe weathered the second chicken better. Well, you can't weather a chicken, but you know, you follow me. I mean, if they had diversified the economy, they would not be so vulnerable to the economic pressures and sanctions that they're feeling now. They didn't. If you're going to engage in this confrontation with the West, you should prep your economy for that. And they didn't. They didn't do that.
Absolutely. And let's be honest, because the sanctions are not really that significant. Yes, they have an impact, of course.
I think the structural sanctions are.
Well, I think what they do is they compound the problems, particularly at the moment, for example, in terms of sort of limiting access to credits and technology and so forth. But I mean, in and of themselves, if exactly as you said, if they had diversified the economy beforehand, if they weren't dependent on the oil, the sanctions would be irksome, but no more than that. Mm. The fact is, it's this sort of perfect storm of oil price, sanctions, and the additional expense of what's going on in the Donbass, which is really proving a critical problem.
And a falling ruble and rising inflation and so on. So my feeling is that since the Nemtsov assassination, there's been this feeling that the regime has not only lost its footing, that the whole thing's about to collapse, as we were talking about in the first half. I mean, this has been building since February. It's been, you know, with Putin's disappearance, with all the craziness we've been seeing the last month, but if you go just a month earlier, Putin was the master of the universe. And this narrative seems to swing, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody. This narrative seems to swing between these two extremes. Does that say more about us than it does about Russia itself? I don't know.
I think it does, though, in fairness, it also, you know, going back to the chattering classes of Moscow, I mean, I think that likewise their chatter tends to be to one extreme or other. I think the thing is, it is just simply a natural human thing. We tend to look for dramatic answers. It's quite hard to hold on to the nuance of the situation. And, you know, there are a lot of voices that in some ways are trying actively or implicitly to drown out the quiet voices of nuance. You know, whether it's RT and its sort of bombastic pretenses, or whether it's also clearly a very Russophobic wing within the West, who likewise, sometimes they want to build up Russia. They want to make it so much more powerful. And I have to say, I'm sorry, but every time I see an American general talking about Russia being a number one threat to the United States or an existential threat, I think, good Lord, A, how ridiculous, and B, wow, you really are empowering Putin.
Well, I think that reflects a debate we're seeing inside the U.S. policy community over what should be prioritized, Russia or ISIS. I mean, this is something we're seeing inside the U.S. But I mean, by virtue of the fact that Russia has nuclear weapons, it is an existential threat. So is Great Britain, for that matter.
Well, yeah, but this is it. But I mean, the day I see a candidate for chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff come up and talk about Britain and France as existential threats. No, I mean, from a military point of view, threat has a very specific term. Threat means not just capacity, but also intent. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the problem. And it's worth mentioning that the day that Martin Dempsey was approved as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I was watching Viesti, and it was the number one news item. And they had a 12-minute package of various generals talking about how Russia was a threat to the United States. Unfortunately, the trouble is that the Russians, or the Russian government itself, wants to play up these extremities. You know, they want to be threatening. One of the most powerful things we could do is actually not play to the Kremlin's own demand and desire to be regarded as a big, powerful beast, and actually, you know, accept the start limitations. But so, you know, to go back to your point about this, the sort of extremity of perspective. Yeah, I mean, it is difficult because, first of all, this is a very opaque regime at the top. There is so much discussion and debate within internet, but even print media, frankly, in Russia. But ultimately, that inner circle, we don't really know what Putin thinks. We don't know what the people close to Putin really think.
We're not even sure who is close to Putin anymore.
Exactly. I mean, I think it is this sort of fascinating and quite worrying sort of situation. And so it becomes a Rorschach ink blot onto which we overlay, you know, and the number of times I have read things, and I've got to be honest here. Sometimes I've written, Putin thinks X, and right. We have to be honest. We don't know. We might think that Putin thinks X, but we have no idea at all, and therefore, we will tend to sort of assume big stuff. When in fact the reality is often this much more banal. I mean, it links back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, sort of, can this regime survive and will it collapse? I mean, actually, the real problems that are building up are deeply structural, but they quite possibly will not lead to anything dramatic happening until there is a shock to the system. Systems, structures like this actually have a fair amount of survivability as long as they don't have to face that kind of challenge.
Yeah, they look solid as a rock till the moment they collapse. But where would you, since life is not binary, it's a spectrum, where would you put us on the spectrum of Putin is the master of the universe, oh my God, the whole thing's about to collapse? Where on that spectrum do you think it is?
Can I turn it into a triangle?
Go ahead.
Because I think, actually, Putin is the master of the universe. I mean, again, that assumes something about Putin's personal power, which frankly has never been true. Putin's strength has always been that, as it were, he has successfully made a deal with the elite. Mm-hmm. You let me sit at the top of this system and it'll be very, very good for you. So in some ways, I mean, he was not so much
seems
the master.
Seems to be reneging on that deal now.
Well, this is it. But the point is, even from the first, he was not the master. He was just in some ways, just, you know, riding the first bull of the herd. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to go with the collapse of the system. I think what we're actually seeing is the weaknesses of the Putin regime beginning to become apparent. The fact that Putin, first of all, is no strategist, has never had any kind of a big long-term picture, has broad aspirations and ambitions, but has never had a blueprint for how you get there. This is why I've always hated all the sort of Putin as the grand chess player type memes. Mm-hmm. He's never had that sense of, in four moves' time, I'll move my rook.
No,
there.
He's a tactician, not a strategist.
Yeah, exactly.
Always has been.
Secondly, actually, Putin's strength has always been his strength in precisely channeling the mood of the upper elite and giving them reasons to be Putinistas. Now he's in a situation where his lack of strategy has really come to bite, and people are aware of that. You know, people within the chattering classes, people within the government elite alike, they know that basically opportunities were squandered. They know that the Donbass was a terrible, terrible mistake. And at the same time, that the circumstances are such that Putin's capacity to actually buy off and win the loyalty of the elite is actually much, much more limited. So in some ways, I think we're seeing that the system is not in and of itself necessarily going to collapse next Wednesday. And it's not because Putin is necessarily, you know, no longer the master of the universe. Putin is the same thing that Putin always was. The point is actually that the Venn diagram of the interests of the state and the interests of the elite are moving, you know, further and further away. There is a smaller and smaller overlap. And Putin finds himself unable to choose between them. He wants a strong Russia. He needs a powerful, corrupt elite. And the chances of maintaining that overlap that he could in the early years, mm-hmm. when he had enough money to do so, he can't do it anymore.
Let's go back to Nemtsov before we wrap it up, since that was the reason to do the second half. I read an interesting piece just before I came into the studio by Valery Portnikov, the Ukrainian political analyst, a keen observer of Russian affairs. And he said basically a year after Nemtsov, basically two sets of rules have been broken. He said the annexation of Crimea and the assassination of Nemtsov represented basically the evaporation of two sets of rules. Crimea, the rule that was evaporated was the rule that Russia would play around the edges of international law, but they wouldn't cross the red lines. And with Crimea, they crossed that, and all bets are off about what Russia will do internationally now under Putin. Nemtsov, prior to the assassination of Nemtsov, officials of that caliber, of that rank, even opposition officials, but, you know, a former deputy prime minister, someone who was once considered to be a potential president, they can be fined, imprisoned, harassed, but they couldn't be killed. And that Putin crossed that line with Nemtsov, or the regime, however you want to define it, crossed that line was crossed. I don't want to. And that means all bets are off now. There's no rules and nobody really knows what to expect, what could happen to them, how they should behave. And that's a very volatile situation. I think I've written similar things in the past myself. Does that also play into this?
Well, I think I'd frame it in slightly different ways. I mean, I don't actually, if one looks at those two points, I don't think I can agree. In terms of Crimea breaking the rules, well, one could look at Georgia. Now, the interesting thing about Georgia is the Russians completely broke the rules, but they were smart enough about it.
They didn't annex territory.
Well,
we are talking about the first annexation of somebody else's territory in Europe since the Second World War.
If one looks at what never mind Abkhazia, but South Ossetia, yes, of course, it's not annexation, but I do think this is a slightly legalistic splitting of hairs. But the point is, I mean, in Georgia, they were smart. They broke the rules, but they were smart enough to do so in a semi-deniable way. They provoked the Georgians into basically giving them the pretext for acting and so forth. So I think, in a way, it's not that the rule that was broken was that Russia would, broadly speaking, obey international law. I think it's that Russia will be smart about how it breaks it. As regards Nemtsov, again, I mean, my view is this was a Kadyrov initiative rather than a Kremlin one. It's not that, as it were, I think the Kremlin has broken the rules about how safe it is to be a senior figure, even an opposition figure. The rule that has been broken is that the Kremlin has control. The interesting thing is that the Kremlin either has demonstrated that it cannot or will not rein in or bring Kadyrov to book. So I think this is the difference. The old order was, look, we are ruthless, exploitative, and self-interested, but we are smart and we're in control. And in, so in that respect, I do think that these two cases demonstrate breaking of the rules, just different sets of rules. What actually has been shown is the Kremlin is not in as much control as it used to be or claimed to be, and also that the Kremlin isn't as smart and wily as people was thought. You can put up with a regime to an extent if you think it is both too dangerous to challenge, but also too effective to want to challenge it. Now, I think that both of those factors are really open for question.
Which means we're probably in for a very interesting autumn, no?
I don't think you need to be winding up the Power Vertical podcast anytime soon.
I certainly hope not, because I always need material for the Daily Vertical. So not that I'm hoping for any disasters or anything, but I expect a very, very eventful autumn, actually.
And winter. I mean, I think the interesting thing will be precisely because for me, the unchronicled but crucial issues is going to be labor unrest, which I've mentioned in the past. And again, if we look historically, most recent histories, in modern Russia, it tends to be late winter, early spring is when we see the most of that. So it'll be interesting to see how hot an early spring we have in Russia.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line has been co-host Mark Eliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Thanks for an enlightening discussion, Mark.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure here, too. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.